Today on Against the Grain, the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline galvanized a generation of activists. It had involved hundreds of tribes and thousands of people standing up against not just the companies that would pollute the region's water, but to the militarized forces of the state. As Native historian Nick Estes argues, the No DAPL efforts brought into sharp focus both two centuries of Native struggles and the complexity of anti-capitalist and decolonial resistance today. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Native resistance to colonialism and capitalism is centuries old, but like indigenous people themselves, the links between generations of movements is often made invisible. Yet, as Nick Estes argues, we can't understand the explosion of resistance against the Dakota Access Pipeline without recognizing those earlier struggles, from opposition to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' dam building and force removals in the Northern Plains, to the Red Power Movement, and to the history of international solidarity between Native peoples and national liberation struggles in places like Palestine. In Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance, published by Verso, he looks at those lineages, stripping away the myth that Native peoples have a past but no present or future, and putting Native people centrally back into the history of anti-capitalist struggles. Nick Estes is Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. I wanted to begin by asking you, Nick, about the origins of the mass efforts to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. If it didn't come out of the blue, and you're arguing that it didn't, what did it come out of?
In the immediate history, it came out of the efforts to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. The Dakota Access Pipeline really caught the world by surprise because we didn't know that it would be a flashpoint for this kind of struggle. And by and large, it really kind of snuck under the radar as far as the construction began in 2016. It was the year after the Obama administration denied the presidential permit for the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. There's a lot of elation, and we felt like history was moving in our direction. The Keystone XL pipeline really represents kind of like a longer kind of struggle that we've been undergoing since 2011. And as we all know, in 2 weeks into his presidency, Trump fast-tracked the Dakota Access Pipeline, then also revived the northern leg of the Keystone XL Pipeline. And so in many ways, this is a sort of long, 8-year struggle that we've been involved in. And so the organizing efforts that went into the DAPL struggle, as we call it, really began with the Keystone XL Pipeline struggle back in 2011. There was a lot of solidarity work done with indigenous and non-indigenous communities along the pipeline route, and organizations such as the Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association was heavily involved in the Keystone XL pipeline struggle. So as much as it was a grassroots struggle, it also had kind of that formal legitimacy with the tribal councils themselves. And so you can even look at the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle and understand that the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where the oil, was being extracted that would eventually flow through the Dakota Access Pipeline, that was going through north of Standing Rock. The Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, the Tribal Council passed a resolution opposing the current route of the pipeline north of or upriver from the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. So even the tribe that was benefiting financially from the construction of this opposed its route. And so it was a really kind of galvanizing moment for us in that way, and brought together you know, just looking at Flag Row, more than 300 different Indigenous nations just in the United States. And that doesn't include the Indigenous nations from Canada, throughout the hemisphere and throughout the world.
And we will talk as we go about the remarkable efforts and the remarkable sense of communal struggle that came out of that. But let's back up quite a bit further. This is a region where Indigenous struggles and dispossession has gone on over centuries, interventions and then counter-movements against them. Can you tell us some of that history, some of it which is your family's history, in that region?
So yeah, this is really, I mean, it's a history book in all senses of the word, and it documents two centuries of resistance led by our people, beginning in 1804 with the arrival and the trespass of Lewis and Clark along our river, penetration of the fur trade in our lands, the arrival of the U.S. military to secure white settlement on our lands, the construction of the dams in the mid-20th century to sort of buy a branch of the military again, and then sort of the North American oil boom in 2007, 2008. So in many ways, we're looking at four invasions. The first invasion was the fur trade with the arrival of Lewis and Clark and the penetration of the United States into our area. And the second invasion was the arrival of the military in the Great Plains, or the Great Plains War, as they were known in the latter half of the 19th century, and the annihilation of the buffalo. The third invasion being the construction of the dams, and the fourth invasion of the North American oil boom. So in many ways, I look at this in a longer arc of history, but in sort of like to condense it down and to look at the more recent history of resistance in the 20th century, which I think often gets ignored by U.S. historians because they often truncate our history between the Wounded Knees, Wounded Knee 1 and Wounded Knee 2, the massacre, and then the uprising and the occupation at the Wounded Knee Hamlet by the American Indian Movement. But between that, those two Wounded Knees, there was an immense amount of resistance, but not sort of the spectacular kind that we're familiar with a confrontation with the state, but more so the kind of what does it mean to make a life out of the prisoner of war camps, now called reservations. And so for my community, for example, the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, we had taken to subsistence economies in the river in the 19th century with the arrival of the fur trade, with disease, with the military, and just the rampant kind of violence of the fur trade industry itself. We fled from the river because it was a source of violence. And during the reservation period, we returned to the river because it provided sort of fertile bottomlands for us to have small-scale agriculture, subsistence agriculture. We could largely live off of the wild game in the area, and also we had small-scale cattle ranching enterprises, right? It wasn't ideal. It was, you know, still the reservation, but in many ways, we made our lives there. And, you know, after the kind of unseasonal flooding and that led to the passage of the 1944 Flood Control Act, which later became known as the Pick-Sloan Plan, the Army Corps of Engineers with the Bureau of Indian Affairs selected five sites on the Missouri River that would disproportionately affect Indian reservations, our reservations. For our tribe, we were relocated not once, but twice. The first was after the construction of the Fort Randall Dam, and the second was after the construction of the Big Bend Dam. But going back to my own family's history, my great-grandfather, Reuben Estes, who was the first tribal chairman, in 1937, opposed the construction of a dam by the state of South Dakota to say, you don't have our consent to build this. And that might not seem like a lot, but at that time period, it was a lot. It was one of our lowest kind of points as a people in many ways. There wasn't kind of an organized resistance against the settler state incursion, but under the powers granted with the Indian Reorganization Act, which was the Indian New Deal, you know, which had a lot of negative effects, like the construction of these dams, but also reorganized us politically and gave us a certain kind of political authority to say no to things like the construction of the dams. So this was really important, and this, in my view, is kind of the galvanized modern indigenous nationalism as we know it today. In even the confrontations and the antagonisms between grassroots struggles and formal tribal governments, because oftentimes we see them as separate. But I would say, even with my own family's history, our family has been actively involved in the treaty councils, which are these grassroots traditional governance systems that still exist and that were revived in many ways and given new life at Standing Rock, because we reunified not according to these IRA or the Indian Reorganization Act tribal councils, but reunified according to treaty and according to traditional governance systems or customary governance systems. And so that's really important to think about, that this isn't just, you know, flashpoints from armed confrontations with the state, but that this is a long, drawn-out struggle. As much as settler colonialism is an accumulation of kind of like violences over time, so too is the resistance to it. And that's what I was trying to draw out in this book.
Right. And that's certainly one of the things that runs through the book, is a reevaluation of the way that the history of Native peoples in this region has been told, and more broadly, this idea that the history of these peoples is actually in the past, mm-hmm. self-contained, and that it doesn't continue, that resistance doesn't continue after a certain point, and that it's all a done deal.
Like truncated.
Right. Tell us more about what the Army Corps of Engineers did in the region and the kind of forced removals that took place. And, you know, this is an area which has gotten some attention recently because of all the flooding in the Midwest, and now reports that Native people have been especially affected by flooding and with very little responsiveness from the U.S. state.
Right. So what's happening in Pine Ridge isn't directly related to the dams, because Pine Ridge doesn't sit along the river, but there are tribes in Nebraska that are along the river, like the Ponca and Winnebago tribes, that are being affected by the flooding that, and you know, many people are blaming the Army Corps of Engineers because they built these dams to prevent flooding in the first place, right? And what's happening in Pine Ridge, but also in these other tribes that are affected by the flooding on the Missouri River, is that, you know, we had the longest government shutdown in history, 35 days, which may, you know, affect people differently who don't live on Indian reservations. But when the primary employer is the federal government and federal programming on Indian reservations, you know, people have to pay for propane in January, which is one of the coldest, you know, months in the Northern Plains, but they can't go to their job, or they're being furloughed, or the hours are being cut. So this is coming out of this devastating government shutdown. And then on top of that, you have kind of the abandonment of investment in infrastructure. And so that's a compounded problem. And as it relates to the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, back in 2011, there was historic flooding. They say that, oh, luckily no people died. But I think that's false, because in our community alone, there were two deaths that were related to the flooding. Roads washed away and people died because of poor infrastructure again, right? So I think the Army Corps of Engineers, in many ways, is this really bizarre institution, because nobody knows who has authority over them. Is it the president? Mm-hmm. Is it Congress? Because when the Congress passed the 1944 Flood Control Act, they authorized the Army Corps of Engineers to build dams, but they never authorized them to extinguish indigenous jurisdiction of the river, which they have done so, you know, which they claim authority and jurisdiction over the river. So that's why the Army Corps played an active role in planning the route of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And many people will point to the Dakota Access Pipeline for being racist and discriminatory against the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. But in fact, it was the Army Corps of Engineers, a branch of the military, who was making the decision to reroute the pipeline from upriver of Bismarck, North Dakota, which is a 90% white populated city, downriver, which was upriver of an 84% Native populated area, which was the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. And they made those decisions when they built the dams as well. They chose to save white settlements at the expense of indigenous lives and lands. And so this isn't just like a new history, right? This is a pattern by the Army Corps of Engineers specifically, but by the U.S. military more generally.
And you're saying that decision was made by this arm of the government rather than by the
corporation, the energy corporation.
Right. Nick Estes is my guest. He is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, and he's the author of Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's talk about the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, bearing in mind that, of course, it involved a struggle against multifarious forces because it wasn't simply energy transfer partners. So what was at stake here? Why do you think this struggle galvanized so many people, Native and also non-Native?
I think to answer that question, we have to look at how the state responded and the state's response to this particular struggle. First of all, the state saw this, and the state with a small s, the state of North Dakota, saw this. It declared a state of emergency, right? These were prayer camps. There was an explicit intention to be nonviolent and to be in prayer and ceremony in these camps, right? It wasn't about an armed conflict or an armed standoff with the state. So the state of North Dakota declares a state of emergency, deploys the National Guard, and then uses the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which was a compact that was created under the Clinton administration to help states solicit aid from other states and other jurisdictions during times of natural disaster or times of social unrest, right? And the last time a state used EMAC was in Maryland in 2015 during the Baltimore Uprising. And so the state of Maryland declared a state of emergency to essentially crush a Black-led uprising against police violence, right? The killing of Freddie Gray. And so the state of North Dakota uses this Emergency Management Assistance Compact to essentially ram through this pipeline, right? And so we have to understand the relationship between the state and these energy corporations, or the state as always being the handmaiden of capital, and specifically the police state, right? There's been a lot of attention paid to the private security firms that were on the ground there, but you know, numbers-wise, they were a considerable minority when you consider the fact that 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions were on the ground, mobilized against water protectors, right? People who were unarmed, in prayer, and who, you know, most of them were indigenous, right? And so I think we have to put that into perspective, right? To understand this, not just in what it meant for indigenous people, but what it meant for the state of North Dakota, but also the federal government, who was fueling a lot of this suppression, right? And now the state of North Dakota, its law enforcement jurisdictions are now touring the country, or had toured the country, and advising other jurisdictions on how to crush specifically indigenous-led uprisings. They were giving trainings to states like Montana, to their state highway patrol, to their local sheriff's county deputies, in how to manage indigenous-led resistance and how to mobilize the forces of the state to crush those indigenous-led resistance, right? So we have to put, I think we should put that into context and then turn to the indigenous people themselves, because that's the infrastructure of settler colonialism and the way that it goes after indigenous movements.
And so in a sense, would it be fair to say that at the same time that the forces of resistance learned all sorts of important lessons from the struggle, so did the forces of oppression in the
exactly.
state.
Yeah. And so like one thing that was really fascinating, it's not in the book, but I usually show it in a PowerPoint presentation, but the Morton County Sheriff's Department would often try to defame and discredit the movement by posting these bizarre infographs. And one of them was showing all the states that all the water protectors that had been arrested had come from, to say, look at all these outside agitators. And we kind of laughed at it because we're like, hell yeah, that's a lot of like solidarity, and look where it's coming from. You know, look at these states that it's coming from. So that's the infrastructure of indigenous resistance in this particular moment in time, in the sense it wasn't just like with my grandparents' generation, nobody cared that they were damming our river. We didn't have an audience. We didn't have millions of people around the world paying attention to what was happening to our river, right? And in this particular moment in time, we did. We had that solidarity. Standing Rock was more than a place, right? It was a movement. You could go to Chicago, Illinois, And you could go to the Indian Center in Chicago, Illinois, and plug right into solidarity work. You could go to New York City with New York Stands with Standing Rock. You could plug right into solidarity work. You could go anywhere in the nation because Standing Rock was on everyone's mind. And it wasn't just Standing Rock. It was indigenous issues first and foremost. And so in that way, that's how I think the resistance in the future is going to look. And that, you know, just understanding, like, for me, how meaningful it was to see people that I had went to high school with, white kids that I had went to high school with, who were disillusioned with a presidential election of 2016. There's no hope in Hillary. There's no hope in Trump. So what's the alternative? Standing Rock. You know, I mean, that's it. There was a small section of those kind of rural white spaces that saw Standing Rock as an actual viable political alternative to the status quo. Neither Democrats and neither Republicans. And to me, it just shows that indigenous resistance is an option for anti-capitalist and anti-colonial struggle in the United States. And if we go even look at a more formal, you know, sort of electoral politics, you can trace the beginning of Deb Haaland and her successful, she's, you know, one of the first Native American congresswomen to be elected to the United States Congress. Her campaign, in my opinion, began at Standing Rock. She was there. She was making, you know, she worked in the kitchens for a while. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez began her, mm-hmm. you know, after the election of Trump, after November 8th, she went to Standing Rock and she began her successful campaign at Standing Rock. And I would argue that the Green New Deal actually arose from the camps at Standing Rock as well. Whatever people think about that is another story. But at the end of the day, I would say that it's not just the opposition to Trump, but it's the alternative to the status quo that really began in Standing Rock and in the camps itself.
Well, and it also comes at a time where for a lot of people who, whether they consider themselves on the left or might be kind of constituents of more left-wing politics, you know, there's a vacuum of positive ideas beyond sort of mere resistance and having something that one could see as actually hopeful. Mm-hmm. Provided something that was missing. But at the same time, that raises the question of what exactly did that look like? Because while it's easy on the outside to just assume that indigenous politics is one thing, mm-hmm. obviously it's not. And it's complex. And so what would you say were sort of the main currents that came out of Standing Rock that one could point to?
Yeah, I think the idea that look, like homogenizing indigenous opposition is a mistake because there are many indigenous nations, as I mentioned earlier, that do participate in the extractive economies, that do participate in capitalism, do align themselves with the United States in kind of the most reactionary forms of nationalism or imperialism. And so it's not to romanticize indigenous people. And I would argue, and I argue this in the book, that I don't think indigenous people provide the solution to climate change. We do have a historical experience and knowledge that should be drawn from, right? But there are elements within the indigenous movement itself that should be examined as sort of this longer, you know, if we look at class struggle in the United States, I was just having this conversation earlier today, we often begin with like a predominantly white labor movement, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that indigenous resistance is a form of class struggle, and it's probably the oldest form of class struggle in this hemisphere. So why don't we start our conversation there? And that's just me saying this as a Marxist and as a leftist, but also a student of history, right? When we struggle or when we study alternatives to, and to say that the United States is not just a sort of teleological thing, that it's not inevitable that these things happened, that choices were made, programs were implemented, that these were very intentional kind of extermination and genocidal policies, right? We also have to understand that indigenous resistance is also, you know, choices were made and it was also very intentional, right? And it has its own, has formed its own sort of knowledge and critique of the state as well as capitalism itself, right? That doesn't mean that we emerge from history unscarred and untouched. We are very much like implicated in that, right? Because when patriarchs came, they left patriarchs when they left, right? When capitalists came, they left capitalists when they left, right? It's just like and so putting that in a sort of global context and understanding indigenous people as colonized people very much, like throughout the world, I think is much more of a productive conversation than just saying that all indigenous peoples resist capitalist development, colonial projects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? I think it's wrong to say that.
Right, and some of it also involves, in the same way that it does for the non-Indigenous left, teasing out the elements of the interpenetration of the settler colonial project and capitalism as well.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's and I think that's why you need a certain kind of analysis, and, you know, I prefer historical materialism to understand these things, because you have to understand how history works. And there are, you know, history operates according to certain structures, right? And so to understand those structures, and oftentimes, you know, there's this, we kind of push the needle of structure versus agency in one way or the other. And I think that's a really pointless debate, because I would say that resistance is also structured by oppression, and oppression is structured by resistance to that oppression. And to me, that's a much more productive conversation, because oftentimes we only understand kind of the faceless behemoth of settler colonialism, mm-hmm. but we don't actually understand, like, what, you know, animated the spirit of resistance, and why does it continue today? Why is it that, you know, our people, the Lakota people, have refused to accept a monetary settlement for our lands, right? We still say the Black Hills are not for sale, but yet we remain some of the poorest people in the North, you know, in North America. Why is that? You know, it's because while we have been colonized, and while we have been sort of imbricated into this capitalist system, we still have remnants of a non-capitalist, or a value system that is non-capitalist, right? And in many ways, I would argue that is anti-capitalist, right? And to me, that's our foundation to build a future society, not just an indigenous society, but one, you know, because decolonization entails both indigenous and non-indigenous people.
And of course, it's very hard to make generalizations about histories as complex as the ones we're discussing, but when you see that with the Lakota people, do you have a sense of the degree to which those anti-capitalist, at some point pre-capitalist, but then ultimately anti-capitalist elements remain or get stamped out? Are there generalities that you can make about the different trajectories of different groups?
What's interesting, you know, oftentimes we look at this, the turn of the century between the 19th and 20th century, is this really kind of catastrophic crackdown on indigenous cultural practices. And we often focus on things like the Sundance or language. But what I noticed when I was reading documents is that across the board, they were against potlatch or giveaway ceremonies, because giving one's wealth away was against, was contra to sort of this kind of hyper-individualistic, you know, materialistic sort of person that they were trying to create indigenous peoples, or trying to assimilate them into being, right, as into private landowners, mm-hmm. Or whatever it was, you know. And I thought that was really fascinating, because I was told this story, and it's not in the book. I wrote it as a separate piece. But the story was told to me about this woman who, in our tribe in Lower Brule, whose son had died during the, I think it was the First World War, he was killed. And she got like a severance check, you know, for his funeral and to handle his affairs. And she started, you know, weeping. And, you know, she began a grieving process. For us, it's like a year long. You keep the spirit of that individual, but then you give away all your worldly possessions, which logically doesn't make sense in our current, you know, capitalist system, right? Why would you give away the things that you just need for life? So she gave away her stove and, you know, her blankets, her food. She cut her hair. She gave away the severance check. It meant nothing to her. And what happened is slowly the community stepped in and began taking care of her, because she couldn't take care of herself because she was in this grieving process. And they, you know, began cooking for her. They provided food and then restored her back, you know, to as best as she could be over that course of the year, and providing that kind of support, right? Those are things that were outlawed at the time, to give away one's possessions, to grieve, right, to mourn. And to me, It's not like we live in, you know, it's not like we can go back home and that still exists, but there's remnants of that kind of collective responsibility that do still exist. And I would say that there's also a capaciousness to certain indigenous societies, and I'm not trying to generalize, to not just take in outsiders, but one of like making relatives and, you know, for political movements, I would call it making comrades. And how do we see those who are fundamentally different, right? How do we make them into familiars, and how do we incorporate them into our struggle? And the goal is not to, you know, indigenize everybody. The goal is to decolonize the land and to reestablish kind of correct and just relations, not just with the land and the non-human world, but with each other as human people.
I'm speaking with Nick Estes. We'll return with him after this music break.
Look at the big one across the sea. I'm sure that you'll agree. There's mean things happening in this world. I ain't got a crying time. I'm not worried all the time. There's mean things happening in this world. There's mean things happening in this world.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Nick Estes. He's co-founder of The Red Nation, and we're discussing his book, Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. That's published by Verso, and at againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that book. So given the kinds of elements, complex elements that make up the reality of Indigenous people today, including those communal aspects of things. When people came together to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline, it was a moment of tremendous linking arms mm-hmm. with each other. And in some ways, would it be fair to say kind of recuperating particular aspects of traditions and not others?
Yeah, I think, you know, what has saved us as a survival mechanism, as Indigenous people, and specifically as Lakota people, is our generosity and our ways of relating, right? And they have often been used against us in many ways, right? But I think to really practice Indigenous sovereignty means to enter into relations with people who are seen as different on our own terms, right? Because oftentimes Indigenous sovereignty is defined by our relationship to the colonizing white supremacist empire known as the United States. And that is the only kind of relation that we're allowed to have is the federal relation, right? But I think there's a long tradition of diplomacy, of relating to, even non-Indigenous people in a way that is productive for us, right? And so instead of asking, you know, how are we different? How are we the same? You know, and I think it's not to over-romanticize, Indigenous kind of ways of relating, but it's an element of Indigenous movements that I would say in the late 20th and early 21st century that has really been generative and in the ways that it's reached out to the world. And I would go back to Standing Rock 1974, as I do in the book, and the formation of the International Indian Treaty Council, which brought together 98 different nations, indigenous nations throughout the Western Hemisphere, 5,000 participants. Some of them were from allied struggles, such as the, you know, the Palestinian struggle or the South African anti-apartheid struggle. But then just the connection and the sense of solidarity and internationalism of that particular period with, you know, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua or the IRA, the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, and seeing these national liberation struggles as co-constitutive and informing each other, and also indigenous people imagining themselves and placing themselves within sort of this global context. Because too often are we placed as sort of domestic dependent nations, but also domestic citizens of the United States, when citizenship is something that we have categorically rejected because it's been imposed, but also the domestication of our nationhood to the colonizing power has also proved very problematic for us as well. And so to be, you know, Vaindaloria has this really amazing saying where he's, you know, to be sovereign, one must act sovereign. And so the way that we acted sovereign is we entered into relations with movements, with, you know, nations of the global south, with non-aligned nations, with communist socialist governments. So there was a sort of a diversity and a capaciousness to how we understood our struggle at that particular time, especially in 1974 when the United States had cracked down on the indigenous movement through COINTELPRO, going after the leadership of our movements, putting them in prison, putting them through the court system. So in many ways, the move to the international arena really saved the movement from collapse.
Do you think that there are clear intergenerational links between the movements of that era, which were, as you say, profoundly internationalist and involved in all sorts of solidarity, with the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline from that generation to now?
Yeah, I think because the level of conversation about indigenous issues in history in the United States is so low that when many U.S. journalists were entering the camps and filming, they ignored things that, you know, that didn't make sense to them. Like, why is there a Palestinian flag flying on flag row, right? To me, it was the first thing you see when you enter the camp. And, you know, that to me, like when I, before Standing Rock, I had interviewed an elder, Elizabeth Cooklin, who was a founder of Native American Studies in the United States, but also a Dakota scholar and activist. She talked about in the 70s and the 80s, during the powwows that they would have in the Northern Plains, that these groups of Palestinians would join the American Indian Movement and doing security detail at the powwows. And they would run drills before grand entry, and they would help serve people and elders and things like that. So they were invited not just by the American Indian Movement, they were actually invited by our tribes, and it wasn't reported in the media because it didn't make sense to people, right? And at that time, the U.S. media and journalists had largely turned against the American Indian Movement, particularly over the question of our international relations with Palestinians and third world, you know, countries and liberation movements.
How did Standing Rock, the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, how did it serve not only as an intense moment of resistance, but as something else as well? You flag the dimension to which a kind of prefigurative politics took place there, a way of thinking about a radically different way to live beyond the capitalist settler present.
I think in moments of crisis and in moments of uprising, history speeds up. And in between those moments, it slows down. It doesn't mean that history stops, but it speeds up. And when it sped up during the No-Dapple camps at the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri Rivers, things that our nations needed, all nations, even non-Indigenous peoples needed, were created. Because the first thing people don't think about this thing, you know, they often think of kind of the spectacular confrontation with the police, and they forget the everyday reality of what it was like to feed thousands of people every single day. Where are you going to get your food? Who's going to cook it? You know, how are those people going to be taken care of? Who's going to take care of all these kids? Where are you going to go to the bathroom? You know, and where are you going to get, you know, security and also healthcare and health issues that you may have? So given the opportunity to construct a society, right, people organize according to need. I would make the argument that we are social beings and our human nature is to be social beings and to take care of one another, right? And in this particular context, it was organized according to indigenous relationality, as well as kind of our grounded authority in the land. And what does it mean to be a water protector, but also what does it mean to be free? And those are things that, you know, I'm an organizer, and I grew up as, you know, an activist and or whatever you want to call it. But that's one thing that I always tell people is that when you experience freedom for the first time, it's an experience that nobody can take away from you. I experienced freedom at my first protest that I went to against the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, where we took the streets of Omaha, you know, and it was very liberating in many ways, because the feelings that I had as somebody who grew up in a white dominated border town in rural South Dakota were validated on the streets of Omaha with, you know, marching with thousands and thousands of people. And I was still in high school, right? That was met with extreme violence by the police. We were pepper sprayed and tear gassed and truncheoned, right? Iraqis had it much worse, don't get me wrong. But in the context of the camps, it was a kind of same dynamic where you had the experience of freedom. People were actually taking control of their lives, but it was surrounded by this immense mobilization of the police, right? And we, in those moments, right, again, history speeds up and we are confronting these issues that we experience in our communities, whether it's heteropatriarchy, just the everyday social violence of poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're planning and actually mapping out what that community would look like. And we knew that the community wouldn't be a permanent community, but nonetheless, the fires, you know, that were lit there, you know, both metaphorically but also physically, were actually taken from those camps and taken elsewhere. They have the coals, you know, they literally took the coals from the main campfire and spread them elsewhere, physically but metaphorically. There were thousands and thousands of young people who experienced freedom for the first time, and you can't take that away from them. And to me, they lived, you know, breathed and felt what it was like to be free in a brief moment of time. And, you know, like I was talking to somebody who worked on youth suicide at the camp, and she was telling me that in her home community, during the winter months, youth suicide is it rises, it spikes, because the winters in the Northern Plains are incredibly hard. But because that resistance camp was there, they hadn't had a single youth suicide. And to me, it's like we have invested so much time and energy in these programs, right, to address a symptom, which is, you know, youth suicide, but not address the root cause, right? And that's when I say, you know, history speeds up in those moments. And it's like, we know what we want. We have it in, like, built in us. It's not an essentialist thing. It's our historical experience, right? We step into the stream of history and we know what we want. We know the direction that stream should be taking us. And we can go back in our own history and find that, right?
Nick Estes is Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and the author of Our History is the Future. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the moments that you're describing of tasting a sense of freedom, from your perspective, from the perspective of looking at the dispossession of Native people and the constant struggle in different forms against it over centuries, what does liberation look like? Like, when we're talking about liberation, mm-hmm. You write that people in the past have fought for the liberation of labor from capital.
Right.
But what is on the table now, or what is necessary, is to liberate the earth from capitalism.
Right.
So when we're thinking of a liberation right now, it obviously isn't just liberation from capitalism, because there's also the component of colonial domination. Mm-hmm. But what would that look like in broad terms?
It's not just the absence of capitalism, and it's also not just the absence of like settler colonialism. I think it's the amplified presence of indigenous life. And what I mean by that is typically in sort of like a Marxist framework, we talk about the movement towards a classless society, right? Where it's not just the annihilation of the bourgeoisie, it's also the annihilation of the proletariat in the sense that there's no longer the subjugation and the power dynamics between the two, right? What's different about decolonization in North America is that you're not trying to annihilate indigeneity, right? You're trying to amplify and grow its presence, right? It's something that has grown in the shadow of empire, right? And so when you remove that shadow, it's going to start blossoming and blooming, right? And I think that's what marks a sort of a decolonial class struggle in the context of the United States is that, yes, we are actually trying to get rid of the settler, not in like a physical, you know, extermination kind of way, but kind of like a settler onticide, the destruction of the settler world in the sense that all the privileges that are granted to settler society. And I say this it's not a cultural thing. It's like literally codified within the law, the dispossession of indigenous land, the positioning of settler rights against indigenous rights, right? So if we look at the pipeline, we can say that under U.S. law or under state law in North Dakota, that pipeline has more rights than indigenous nations, right? Because it's always private property rights will always trump the sanctity of indigenous lives, right? So it's not just a cultural thing and saying that, oh, there's white privilege. You know, it's actually codified. It's something that people live with on a daily reality. The fact that their water will eventually be contaminated by a leak in the pipeline, the fact that, you know, there's purposeful maldevelopment or underdevelopment within the reservation system and that they have no control over the sort of direction or the destiny that they want to take. And so liberation is really just about having the ability to choose. And it's the most radical form of democracy. It's not just, you know, self-determination in the abstract, but it's actually controlling one's destiny. Absent settler colonial rule, absent sort of the coercive system of the profit motive, but the amplification of indigenous governance systems, right? And I would argue that this includes non-indigenous people who currently live on our land, because they have a role to play as well in restoring our land and restoring our livelihoods. It's hard for me to like say this in the future. I'm a historian. I look backwards with an eye to the future. So I kind of walk backwards to the future. You know, I look at what came before us, that is propelling us towards that future.
You write in your book, Our History is the Future, about the importance of particular types of relationships within indigenous culture. And of course, capitalism itself is absolutely, as you flagged, about particular social relations and ways that our lives are structured in relationship to each other. You also mentioned that what poor Native people and poor white people have been presented as inevitable enemies forevermore.
Right.
How do you see those relationships getting reconfigured, not simply in the glorious future where we leap over all problems, but en route to radically transforming the world that we're living in?
So white supremacy and settler colonialism, we often think of as controlling indigenous people or people of color or black folks, right? Controlling their behaviors, our behaviors. But we often forget that white supremacy and settler colonialism are also about controlling the behaviors of white folks, and specifically that class element that you just brought up, that, you know, the person who is a clerk at a grocery store in South Dakota has nothing in common with Jeff Bezos. They have nothing in common with, you know, Christine Noem, who is a wealthy white landowner and currently the governor of South Dakota, right? They have nothing in common with them. They have no class interest. But yet white supremacy prevents a sort of alliance, a class alliance with indigenous folks, right? And to understand that not only are indigenous people and our treaties beneficial for white folks, but white supremacy is also killing white folks, right? I just think about the town that I grew up in, at Chamberlain, South Dakota, and, you know, being growing up in a trailer park where there was, you know, there was indigenous people, such as myself, our family, and white folks. And growing up, there was no difference between us in the sense that, like, we just, you know, they were my friends. And it wasn't until we learned racism and we learned that separation that there was kind of that ingrained racism and anti-indigenous attitude, right? That's not to say that, you know, once we get rid of this, then everything will be perfect. It's something that has to be fought for and struggled over, right? And I would say that it's not just about, I think people think of this in the terms of interest, like it's not just in the interest of poor white folks to ally with indigenous people. It's like, it's a necessity at this point in time. We have 10 years, right, before we experience, you know, irreversible. I mean, climate change is already irreversible, but the most deleterious effects of that, right? All people have a vested interest in that and in seeing that project through. What makes it different is that indigenous people, and thinking about decolonization and anti-capitalist struggle, indigenous people, people of color, frontline communities, the global South has a much larger say in how that future world is going to look like, right? But I, you know, some people, like, there's on the left, there's this kind of conception of like accomplices, not allies kind of thing. But I would say, like, we need comrades, not just accomplices. And we need comrades, not just allies. We need people who are going to stand next to us, not in front of us and not behind us, but understand that indigenous rights, you know, in many ways will protect other people's rights, but they have to be front and center when we talk about like things like the Green New Deal or an anti-colonial or decolonial future.
Nick Estes, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on, Sasha.
Nick Estes is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. He is assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and co-founder of The Red Nation. We've been speaking about his book, Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. That's published by Verso. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.